طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The continuing attempts by Palestinian leaders to gain international recognition for Palestine sticks in Israel's craw. Israel's apartheid society is under increasing scrutiny by the international community, and it is losing the worldwide public relations battle as its discriminatory policies are exposed. So when the Vatican signed its first treaty with the Palestinians, calling for courageous decisions to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and backing a two-state solution, Israel was upset. Here is how the Daily Star out of Lebanon recorded the event. The treaty which made official the Vatican's de facto recognition of Palestine since 2012 angered Israel, which called it a hasty step that damages the prospects for advancing a peace agreement. Israel also said it could have implications on its future diplomatic relations with the Vatican. The accord, which concerns the Catholic Church's activities in areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority, also confirmed the Vatican's increasing proactive role in foreign policy under Pope Francis. Last year, it brokered the historic resumption of ties between the United States and Cuba. Archbishop Paul Gallagher, the Vatican's foreign minister, said at the signing that he hoped it could be a stimulus to bringing a definitive end to the long-standing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which continues to cause suffering from both parties. He called for peace negotiations held directly between Israelis and Palestinians to resume and lead to a two-state solution. This certainly requires courageous decisions, but it will also offer a major contribution to peace and stability in the region, he said. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki said he hoped it would help recognition of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination, freedom, and dignity in an independent state of their own, free from the shackles of occupation. The Vatican is particularly keen to have a greater diplomatic role in the Middle East, from where many Christians have fled because of conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and other countries. There are about 100,000 Catholics of the Roman and Greek Melkite rites in Israel and Palestine, most of them Palestinians. Gallagher said the agreement may serve as a model for other Arab and Muslim-majority countries with regard to freedom of religion and conscience. The UN General Assembly adopted a resolution in 2012 recognizing Palestine as an observer non-member state. This was welcomed at the time by the Vatican, which has the same observer non-member status at the United Nations. Since then, the Vatican has de facto recognized the state of Palestine, and the Pope referred to it by that name when he visited the Holy Land last year. Some 135 members of the United Nations recognize Palestine, nearly 70% of the total. By comparison, 160 of the UN's 193 members recognize Israel. Last October, Sweden became the first major European country to acknowledge Palestine, a decision that drew condemnation from Israel and has since led to tense relations between the two. The European Union as a whole does not recognize Palestine, taking the same view as the United States that an independent country can emerge only via negotiations with Israel, not through a process of unilateral recognition. We keep looking for some positive signs that our Congress is breaking from its lockstep support of the Israeli lobby's positions, which are so skillfully scripted as talking points for our congressional representatives. Perhaps we have found one. Kate Gould writes in Mondo Weiss, "In arguably the strongest signal Congress has ever sent in support for Palestinian human rights, 19 members of Congress sent a letter to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urging the Department of State to make the human rights of Palestinian children a priority in the U.S. bilateral relationship with Israel." The letter was led by Representative Betty McCollum from Minnesota, and the letter's other signatories include both co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and members serving on the Armed Services Committee, the Selective Committee on Intelligence, the Appropriations Committee, and the Ways and Means Committee. These 19 members of Congress call on the Department of State to elevate the human rights of Palestinian children to a priority status in our bilateral relationship with the government of Israel. And note that they fully expect the State Department to address the status of Israel's military detention system's treatment of Palestinian children in its annual human rights report. Representative Betty McCollum makes it clear that this letter is intended to result in decisive action. In the Congresswoman's own words, "Israel's military detention of Palestinian children is an indefensible abuse of human rights." I hope this letter results in State Department pressure on the government of Israel to end this systematic abuse immediately. Palestinian children should be treated exactly the same as Israeli or American children, without the fear that one day soldiers will arrest them, beat them, and lock them away in prison. The groups advocating in support of the letter include American Friends Service Committee, Friends Committee on National Legislation, Defense of Children International Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, Amnesty International USA, Pax Christi USA, and Churches for Middle East Peace. Amnesty International highlighted for advocates the stark contrast between the two separate and unequal legal systems in play that is so fundamental to Israel's military occupation. While Palestinian children and adults face Israeli military courts, Israeli settlers benefit from Israeli civil law. Sonji Berry, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for the Middle East and North Africa, noted, "Israel gives settlers a different system of justice, even though they are living illegally in the very same occupied Palestinian territories." The letter comes just weeks after the launch of the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, led by the Chicago Faith Coalition on Middle East Policy. American Friends Service Committee, Defense for Children International Palestine, and supported by various Christian, Jewish, and Muslim organizations. The committee kicked off with an interfaith vigil held in the U.S. Capitol on June 1st, the International Day for the Protection of the Child. The following day, the American Friends Service Committee hosted a congressional briefing on child detention in Israeli Palestine, Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota introduced the briefing and was followed by remarks from various human rights experts. Tariq Abu Khadir presented on his experience as a Palestinian American brutally beaten by Israeli police and subsequently detained when he traveled to Israel-Palestine for the memorial service of his cousin Mohammed Abu Khadir, who was burned alive by Israeli settlers. The only congressional representative from Massachusetts to sign the letter was Jim McGovern.
No one documents Israel's apartheid society more thoroughly than journalist and author Max Blumenthal, which is why he is persona non grata not only in Israel, but also in the United States, where the mainstream media continues to ignore him and deny him a platform or review his books. Zionists often personally attack him in the media, but because his work is so well documented, it is not questioned. Because of the quality of his work, we continue to provide a platform for his work on This Week in Palestine. So once again today, we feature a presentation by Max Blumenthal, this time speaking at the University of Paris, where initially his speech was canceled because of pressure put on the university by Zionist supporters. With the charges of censorship ringing in their ears, university authorities reversed themselves and finally allowed Max to speak. Here is that controversial presentation at the University of Paris.
I have 20 minutes to tell you that apartheid is real. And I'm told to speak very slow. First, I apologize. There's no protest, so sorry to the youth. I was hoping to speak from a balcony with a megaphone to the angry masses and, you know, start a rebellion. Fortunately, we didn't have to go there. We learned that some speech is freer than others in post-Charlie France. But you should give yourselves a round of applause, because it was because of your pressure and your outrage and your action that we are actually in this room right now and not out in the cold. And that is an achievement for this movement, so you should feel free to give yourselves a round of applause. Or you can wait for the translation of what I just said. So, 2 days ago, Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi, declared that he will never cede land to the Palestinians, ever. He said this over and over again, but finally, the media is paying attention, and Netanyahu is likely to be the next prime minister. He's saying there will never be two states, and he's right. I see no possibility for a sovereign Palestinian state in my lifetime, and I don't know where Israel is. And I will offer anyone in this room 100 euros if you can bring me a piece of paper and accurately draw Israel on it, because you can't do it. Israel has no internationally recognized borders. They're constantly growing. So we are in a one-state reality, and that's where this entire conversation flows from, and that is why BDS is necessary. Everyone is living under a single regime from the river to the sea, and it is the regime of the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant, or JSIL. Jesh instead of Dash. Rights flow from ethnicity and religion in JSIL. And religion is racialized. Everyone receives their rights based on who they are. And I, as an American Jew with no Israeli citizenship, have more rights in the land of Israel-Palestine than Bilal or any Palestinian on earth, and it's simply because I have J-positive blood. There are five matrices of control that govern the lives of Palestinians, and each Palestinian is fits into one of these five designs. The first was described to you by Bilal. It's the matrix of control that governs the West Bank, which is the Israeli military occupation overseen by the Orwellian-named Civil Administration Authority. It's actually a military administration. It oversees the courts, which impose administrative detention on Palestinian prisoners. They can be detained without charges. They are put on trial in a military kangaroo court in the Ofer military prison, where there was a 99.97% conviction rate. There is a special children's court. And I have personally witnessed multiple children as young as 14 years old put on trial for stone throwing. They're arrested at night, and they're often held for months without charges. They live in one of the either Area C or B, which are full or partial Israeli military control. Area A, the main Palestinian population clusters like Bethlehem, are controlled supposedly by the Palestinian Authority, but the Palestinian Authority is simply the native arm of the Israeli military and exists as a contractor of the occupation to arrest, control, and dominate Palestinians on behalf of Israel. Palestinians in the West Bank have no legal rights, no property rights, no human rights. In fact, it is illegal to gather in a group larger than 12, which is why you see demonstrations fired upon and broken up with everything ranging from rubber-coated steel bullets to the chemical known as skunk to tear gas and now to live fire under Israel's new unspoken policy of shoot to cripple, where live bullets are fired at the knees and the abdomens of protesters, which is why we're seeing increasing number of casualties in the West Bank, higher than at any time since the Second Intifada. Apartheid is real in Jerusalem, the second matrix of control. East Jerusalem, which was supposed to be the future capital of a Palestinian state, is occupied territory under international law, and no Israeli government has any intention of ever allowing it to be controlled by Palestinians. That's why they refer to an eternal, undivided Jerusalem. And that means that the 300,000 Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem, who have Jordanian residency, are controlled by a heavily militarized Israeli police force. And they are governed by apartheid policies. One of the most ironic policies that's been applied to this population are home evictions, in which Jewish settlers who claim that they can prove that their families lived in Palestinian homes prior to 1948 can take over those homes, and the families will be thrown out with just 15 minutes notice in the middle of the night. We saw that in Sheikh Jarrah. We see it in Beit Hanina. We're seeing it especially in Silwan. And this is a complete reversal of the law that's applied to Palestinians, where if they lived there before 1948 and they left, they're refugees and they can never return. So the right of return applies to Jews only, and there is actually the first law that the state of Israel ever passed, the law of return, which it gives me the right to return to a place that my family supposedly lived in 3,000 years ago. Because I have like the pager number of Maimonides, and I can like hit up Moses on my cell phone. Like, I have any connection to these people. My family's from the Ukraine and Russia, and you know, this is ridiculous. But if you say otherwise, you're an anti-Semite, because I'm a Semite and you're not. Can I just add another policy in Jerusalem that is essential to understand is the center of life policy. And this is how Jerusalem is depopulated. Palestinians in East Jerusalem have to constantly prove that they live there, prove to the Jerusalem municipality. That means they have to constantly show that they pay their bills, they have to show paperwork. If they have a child there, the birth has to be recorded in Jerusalem or the child doesn't exist. For example, if the child's born in the West Bank, the child has no papers. And so for those Palestinians in Jerusalem who maybe go to Bir Zeit University in the West Bank and meet a partner there and get married, and that partner has a Huia, Palestinian Authority, papers, and lives in the West Bank, there's only one place the two of them can live without the Jerusalem Palestinian losing their residency. And it's Kufr Aqab, which is basically a refugee camp for lovers. It exists on the other side of the separation wall, so it's separated from Jerusalem by a wall, but it's technically part of the Jerusalem municipality, so you're still in Jerusalem. What does that mean for these couples? It means that they're living in an area with no public services, but they're paying close to 1,000 shekels a month, which is like, I don't know, 200 some euros in taxes. They have no trash pickup, so there's just trash everywhere. No street repair, so the streets are just filled with potholes. No police, so people have to police themselves. No street lights. No fire department, because the Palestinian Authority fire crews are not allowed to enter, and the Jerusalem fire crews can't pass through the walls. So if that isn't apartheid, I don't know what apartheid is. And actually, this is interesting, because I said how Palestinians in East Jerusalem have to constantly prove their presence. Jews in West Jerusalem, and even Jews in East Jerusalem, many of them live somewhere else. They're wealthy Jews from the U.S. and from France who own property there and never have to prove their presence. I found this magazine of the Jewish community in France, or some part of it, in the memorial outside the kosher supermarket. And it's pushing Aliyah, or a mass immigration, to Israel. The Israeli government has an ad on the back, so they want to clear France of its Jewish population. And they're advertising on the inside residences in East Talpiot, which is an illegal settlement in East Jerusalem, where no one has to prove their residency. Many of these towers are actually referred to as ghost towers because they're empty during the winter when Jews from the diaspora are back home working. And Bilal, you're not allowed to live there. Sorry.
It's my village.
Yeah. So the most complicated part of this discussion is when you bring up Israel proper, or those who are governed by Israeli civil law, which because supporters of Israel will say, well, our Arabs, you know, we're so nice to our Arabs, we let them vote. We have democracy. It's not apartheid. They have parties, and our Arabs are happy. You know, crumbs from the master's table, they get lots of them. But if you actually look at the laws, there are over 50 discriminatory laws, according to Adala, the Center for the Legal Rights of the Arab Minority in Israel. And they're constantly putting new laws on the books that make it more and more clear what this system is about. For example, the acceptance to community law, which was passed in 2011, authorizes communities of under 500 to discriminate on the basis of race and religion, meaning Jews-only communities are authorized. But Israel has always had these kinds of laws. They were just less explicit. For example, the Jewish National Fund law, passed in 1964, authorizes or guarantees that the Jewish National Fund has 7 out of 13 seats on the board of the Israel Lands Administration. It's starting to sound Byzantine and complex. The Israel Lands Administration controls all public land in Israel, which is basically all land. The Jewish National Fund only technically controls 20%. But through these controlling these seats, it really controls all land. And on its website, the Jewish National Fund says its mission is to provide land to the Jewish people. So it is a Jews-only landlord that controls all of the land that's leased in Israel, which is why it's impossible for Arab communities to expand according to their natural growth. And beyond that, the Jewish National Fund has a design in the Negev Desert, where over 100,000 Bedouin citizens of Israel live. 80,000 live in unrecognized communities. They can't be recognized because their residents aren't Jewish. And if they're not recognized, they can't receive public services. All construction is considered illegal, can be demolished at any time. And the Jewish National Fund has a plan called the Praver Plan, which is temporarily suspended, P-R-A-W-E-R, to remove 60,000 indigenous Bedouins, citizens of Israel, and place them in townships built by the state, which are the only Arab towns the state of Israel has ever built in its history, which are designed to concentrate the Bedouin population, and replace those towns with Jews-only communities. One town which has resisted, Al-Araqib, has had its structures demolished 82 times since 2010. 82 times. And the families are now living in the cemetery. The Jewish National Fund is planning to build a Jews-only community on top of their town. And the Jewish National Fund is a nonprofit in the United States and in Canada and in France. It's committing these acts of terror against an indigenous population, and no one is trying to shut it down like they shut down Muslim charities who are simply sending aid to Gaza. So this is merely one small aspect of apartheid inside Israel proper. And because I have limited time, I can't go further on that, on Israel, but we'll move to another area after this brief translation. The fourth matrix of control exists in the Gaza Strip. When Israel enacted its disengagement with the Gaza Strip beginning in 2005, it declared that it had no responsibility for the population of the Gaza Strip under the Geneva Conventions and international law, and that the Gaza Strip was no longer occupied, but it simply... employed the panopticon system of occupation, which is to govern a population as prisoners are governed. To effectively administer a prison, you only need to control 1% of the prison according to the panopticon theory, and that is the perimeter of the prison. And so Gaza is controlled through a naval blockade, which prevents fishermen from going more than 4.5 miles at sea in reality. From the east, it is completely encircled with concrete walls and electrified fences, which are covered with remote-controlled machine guns. Anyone who enters the 300-meter buffer zone, which is some of the only farming land in the Gaza Strip, can be shot. Many can be shot by remote control. Since yesterday was International Women's Day, the Israeli army celebrated its female soldiers. Those who control the ceasefire guns, that's what they're called, do so in an office far away in the Negev Desert. They are all female soldiers, and the joysticks are smaller for female hands. That was reported in Haaretz. So all goods in the Gaza Strip, everything that goes in and out, is controlled either by Israel or the Zionist government of Egypt and General Fatah al-Sisi and his military junta. The border, since the war, the border of Rafah in Egypt has only been open for 3 days. So people are basically trapped in Gaza. Gaza is constantly patrolled by Israeli drones at all times. Neighborhoods are filled with collaborators who are manipulated by the Israeli Security Service. It is the most heavily surveilled piece of earth on the planet. The Israeli military administration, which governs the Gaza Strip, has used complex mathematical formulas to determine how many calories each resident should receive. They have determined that each resident of the Gaza Strip should receive 2,249 calories per day, which is just above famine level, but not a substantial amount of calories. The former Israeli government advisor Dove Weisglass said, "We won't allow them to starve, we'll just put them on a diet." And so goods are limited to the Gaza Strip, but goods are available. All of these goods are Israeli goods, almost all of them, when you go into a market in Gaza, which makes BDS almost impossible. And there's a logic to this. Gaza is a literally captive market for the Israeli economy. The Gaza Strip and the West Bank, the occupied territories, are the number two export market for Israel. So Israel incentivizes occupation. Not one more point. Weapons are tested on the population of the Gaza Strip that cannot be tested elsewhere, as well as new methods of surveillance, and then they are exported as field tested. So between Operation Cast Lead, which ended in early 2009, and Operation Pillar of Defense in November 2012, Israel increased its military exports by $1 billion by testing new weapons on Palestinians. Therefore, it proves that occupation is profitable. And let me make one quick other point on apartheid in Gaza. Because we're making an analogy to South African apartheid. And South African apartheid was an abominable system. But this is apartheid on steroids. This is arguably worse than South African apartheid, because the apartheid government never bombed its Bantustans with 2,000 and 5,000 pound missiles, and the South African apartheid government needed black labor. They needed to exploit black labor. Israel does not need Palestinians. They are warehousing Palestinians permanently in the Gaza Strip as surplus people. It's a warehouse for the non-Charlies. And it's because they're not Jewish. If they were Jewish, the walls would come down tomorrow. And the final matrix of control is one of exclusion and removal. And that is what governs the Palestinian refugees, those who were removed from their homes between September 1947 and the cessation of hostilities of the 1948 war, sometime in late 1948, and thereafter. There were many, many removals in the years afterwards. Israel passed a law called the Prevention of Infiltration Act in 1951, I believe. This was way before the occupation began, 16 years before the occupation, and this law declared that anyone who had left their homes in that period was not a refugee. Therefore, Resolution 194 of the United Nations, which authorizes the right of return for refugees, and the International Conventions on Refugees, all international law which had been passed was nullified. These refugees were declared infiltrators, as if they had had no home in Palestine before. And if they ever set foot within Israeli-controlled territory, they could be forcibly removed. And they have been ever since Israel was established. I mean, we're talking about 750,000 people and their descendants. There are now something like 7 million Palestinian refugees in the world. None can enter. We saw what happened on May 15th, Nakba Day 2011, when refugees from Lebanon attempted to march to their ancestral homeland and were shot with live fire by Israeli soldiers. Over 20 were killed. This was a nonviolent demonstration, the kind that Western liberals always ask Palestinians to embark on. But when they get shot, there's no solidarity for them. The Prevention of Infiltration Act was recently updated. It was updated in 2012 to apply to the 60,000 non-Jewish African asylum seekers who live inside Israel, who have been denied work permits and denied the ability to find housing. Many of them sleep out in the open in Tel Aviv and are victims of regular racist hate crimes. Under this law, the state can detain any African asylum seeker without any suspicion that they've committed a crime and imprison them for 3 years without charges. And so thousands have been rounded up in the streets, first identified as being black, the crime of blackness, taken to a camp in the desert, either Holot or Saharonim, and they are being warehoused there without charges simply for not being Jewish. So the entire system of apartheid applies to anyone who is not Jewish. We have to recognize that the greatest threat to Israel is not rockets from Hamas or rockets from Hezbollah. It is democracy. And when you are accused of wanting to destroy Israel, it's because you want to democratize Israel-Palestine, which will actually improve the lives of everyone who's living there. There's enough room for everyone in Israel-Palestine, including African asylum seekers fleeing genocide in Darfur. And so we just need to simply make it so. And the only tactic available to us, which you're going to speak about now, is BDS.
That was journalist and author Max Blumenthal speaking at the University of Paris. And speaking of BDS, over the last few weeks, three remarkable op-eds by church leaders have been published in the U.S. regional newspapers in support of some measure of BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The op-eds are remarkable because they honor BDS as a tool, and two of them specifically reject the equation of BDS with anti-Semitism, a charge that cowed many non-Jewish activists in times gone by. And all three slam the right-wing Israeli government for defying international opinion or using the peace process to expand. So the churches must act, the leaders say. All Israel supporters who criticize BDS as a means of excusing Israel's endless colonization need to read these op-eds. They show that the Netanyahu government has been a boon to the BDS movement, and that enlightened Americans are watching developments in Palestine closely. The op-eds. First, the Episcopal Church. Newland Smith, Senior Deputy to General Convention from the Diocese of Chicago in the Salt Lake Tribune, argues that the Church's earlier posture of constructive engagement has failed. The Israeli government has explicitly rejected the two-state solution and uses the cover of peace talks to gobble up more land. In 2005, the Episcopal Church's Executive Council adopted a resolution calling for the Church to engage in corporate engagement and investment in the Palestinian economy. A decade later, a new political landscape has taken shape, in which the Israeli government has explicitly rejected the two-state solution, which has been the basis of U.S. and international peacemaking efforts for more than 20 years, and continues to relentlessly expand its illegal settlements and entrench its occupation of Palestinian lands. Yet the Episcopal Church's support for Palestine freedom and self-determination has not progressed to reflect these realities. In the 10 years since the Executive Council's decision to pursue corporate engagement and positive investment, the number of Israeli settlers living in the occupied Palestinian West Bank and East Jerusalem has increased from approximately 430,000 in 2005 to over 650,000 today. For more than two decades, Israel has used unresolved peace talks as cover to expand settlements in the very lands where a Palestinian state is proposed. The status quo permanent occupation with no solution in sight is unendurable for the 4.4 million Palestinians who are now living under the third or fourth generation of Israeli military rule. Taking such a step toward divesting from Israel's occupation will align our investments with our principles and serve, along with the actions of other churches and institutions, including a growing number of Jewish organizations and voices in Israel and the U.S., to help exert pressure for a just and peaceful end to the destructive status quo of permanent occupation. The United Church of Christ. John H. Thomas is the former General Minister and President of the United Church of Christ. He writes about a stridently expressionist new Israeli government, making it necessary for the church to act against a morally corrupt status quo. What the divestment resolution will do is allow the United Church of Christ to join a growing chorus of religious and civil society groups around the world no longer willing to tolerate a morally corrupt status quo that grows ever more oppressive for Palestinians and dangerous for Israelis. In the face of a stridently expansionist new Israeli government, the resolution calls upon the church and its members to end their complicity as consumers, investors, and citizens with an illegal occupation. And it offers solidarity to Palestinian Christian partners for whom hope remains the last fragile bulwark against despair, departure, or violence. He rejects the BDS demonization campaign. BDS is a tradition in the church. Consideration of this resolution comes amid an intense campaign by the Israeli government and its far-right supporters in the United States to discredit all criticism of current Israeli policies. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has now elevated familiar charges of anti-Semitism to comparisons of the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement with Nazi Germany. The charge is both absurd and cruel and meant to intimidate concerned onlookers into silence. Carefully targeted boycott and divestment strategies are extraordinary actions for the church, but not unprecedented. In the past, the UCC has engaged in these tactics to support migrant farm and textile workers, to change corporate policies dangerous to poor mothers and their infants, to press for the end of apartheid in South Africa, and to reduce reliance on climate-damaging fossil fuels. At a time when deep discouragement over the prospects for peace threatens to overwhelm, this resolution before the Synod signals a refusal to surrender faith in the God who promises courage in the struggle for justice and peace. Lastly, here is the Reverend Steve Junkite of the First Congregational Church of Old Lyme, Connecticut, who is an author supporting BDS in the New Haven Register. He led a trip of Muslims and Christians to Palestine in March. During our travels, we met a Christian priest living in the occupied territories. To go to Jerusalem, he has first had to obtain permission from Israel's military and then wait in a long line, only to be told by a teenage soldier that he may not enter today. The priest persists, saying he only wants to pray at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. All he gets is a shrug, "Not today." The priest's experience is shared by millions of Palestinians attempting to cross the separation wall every day. We met a Muslim Palestinian teacher who used to pray at Masjid al-Aqsa in Jerusalem every week, but has not been to Jerusalem for 22 years. He said, "God does not want me to be humiliated every time I go to pray."
It is a heartbreaking statement, but one his occupiers would endorse. Here's Junkite's declaration that Israel's new government's obstructionism demands action. Despite our government's repeated efforts, Israeli officials have scoffed at and even insulted their peacemaking efforts while subsidizing the illegal settlements. Furthermore, while we were there during the Israeli election, Prime Minister Netanyahu reiterated that on his watch there will be no Palestinian state. He has since cynically, quote, changed his position. Peace requires action. When governments are unwilling, other tactics become necessary. The United Church of Christ is about to consider a resolution concerning boycotts and divestment from companies that profit from Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands. The Presbyterian Church USA and the United Methodist Church have passed similar resolutions. These are part of a wider campaign of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions that is gaining traction throughout the world. Junkite also defies the charge that BDS is anti-Semitic. It is a moral response. Boycotts and divestments are not anti-Semitic. These strategies are born from understanding the ethical dimensions of all three Abrahamic faiths and the experience of other historic movements against oppression that have used these methods to leverage social change. All three op-eds show the power of liberal Christians to play an important role in the struggle. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.